Chapter 73. The waitress was overworked and slow, so I left Monroe to receive the pies alone, and I headed back to the Dogleg Alley. I came out between Brannan's bar and the loan office and saw that a few cars had left, and the crowd on the open ground had thinned considerably, much more so than the few absent cars could explain. So I figured people were inside at that point, drinking away their last precious minutes of freedom before heading home for the night. I found most of them inside Brannan's bar itself. The place was packed. It was seriously overcrowded. I wasn't sure if Carter County had a fire marshal, but if it did, the guy would have been having a panic attack. There must have been 100 rangers and 50 women in there, back to back, chest to chest, holding their drinks up neck high to avoid the crush. There was a roar of sound, a loud, generalized amalgam of talk and laughter, and behind it all I could hear the cash drawer slamming in and out of the register. The river of dollars was back in full flow. I spent 5 minutes fighting my way to the bar, on a random route left and right through the crowd, checking faces as I went, some up close, some from afar. But I didn't see Reed Riley. The Brannan brothers were hard at work, dealing beer in bottles, taking money, making change, dumping wet dollar bills into their tip jar, passing and repassing each other in their cramped space with moves like dancers. One of them saw me and did the busy barman thing with his chin and his eyes and the angle of his head. And then he recognized me from our earlier conversation, and then he remembered I was an MP, and then he leaned in fast, like he was prepared to give me a couple of seconds. I couldn't remember if he was Jonathan or Hunter. I asked him, "Have you seen that guy, Reed? The guy we were talking about before?" He said, "He was in here 2 hours ago. By now he'll be wherever the shots are cheapest." "Which is where?" "Can't say for sure. Not here, anyway." Then he ducked away to continue his marathon, and I fought my way back to the door. I got back to the diner 16 minutes after I left it, and found that the pies had been delivered in my absence, and that Monroe was halfway through eating his. I picked up my fork, and he apologized for not waiting. He said, "I thought you were gone." I said, "I often take a walk between courses. It's a Mississippi thing, apparently. Always good to blend in with the local population." He said nothing in reply to that. He just looked a little bemused. I asked, "What are you doing in Germany?" "Generally?" "No, specifically. As in, when you get there first thing in the morning, the day after tomorrow, what's on your desk?" "Not very much."
"Nothing urgent?"
"Why?"
3 women were killed here," I said, "and the perp is running around free as a bird."
"We have no jurisdiction."
"Remember that picture in Emmeline McClatchy's parlor? Martin Luther King?" He said, "All that needs to happen for evil to prevail is that good men do nothing."
"I'm a military cop, not a good man."
He also said, "The day we see the truth and cease to speak is the day we begin to die."
"That stuff is way above my pay grade."
He also said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
"What do you want me to do?"
"I want you to stay here," I said. "One more day." Then I finished my pie and went looking for Elizabeth Devereaux again. It was 11:31 when I left the diner for the second time. I turned right and walked up to the sheriff's department. It was locked up and dark, no vehicles in the lot. I kept on going and turned the corner onto the Kellam Road. There was a stream of traffic coming out from behind Main Street. One car after another. Some were full of women and turning left. Most were full of Rangers and turning right. At least three, and sometimes four guys in each car. Bravo Company going home. Maybe they had a midnight curfew. I glanced down to the acre of beaten dirt and saw every single car except my Buick in motion. Some were just starting up and backing out. Others were maneuvering for position, getting in line, getting ready to join the convoy. I kept on walking, on the left-hand shoulder, keeping my distance from the traffic heading for Kelham. A lot of beer had been consumed, and the designated driver concept was not big in 1997. Not in the Army, anyway. Dust was coming up off the road, and bright headlight beams were cutting through it, and motors were roaring. 200 yards ahead of me, cars were thumping over the railroad track and then accelerating away into the darkness. Devereaux was right there, sitting in her car on the far side of the crossing. She was facing me. She was parked with her wheels on the shoulder of the road. I walked toward her, with Bravo Company overtaking me all the way, maybe 90 of them in 30 cars in the minute it took me to reach the railroad. By the time I got there, the stream was already thinning behind me. The last of the stragglers were passing me by, 5 and 10 and 20 seconds between each one. They were driving fast, chasing after their more punctual friends. I waited for a break in the traffic long enough to get me safely over the track, and Devereaux opened her door and got out to meet me. We stood there together, lit up bright by the oncoming headlights. She said,
5 more minutes and they'll all be gone. But I have to wait until Butler and Pellegrino get back. I can't go off duty before they do. That wouldn't be fair.
I asked, when will they get back?
The train takes a whole minute to pass a given point, which doesn't sound like much, but it feels like an hour when you've been working all evening, so they'll try to make it before midnight.
How long before midnight? She smiled.
Not long enough, I'm afraid. 5 to, maybe. We wouldn't get home in time.
I said, pity. She smiled wider. She said,
get in the car, Reacher.
She started the motor and waited a moment as the last of the Bravo Company stragglers sped by. Then she eased off the shoulder and maneuvered out to the humped crown of the pavement, and then she turned a tight right that put us up on the crossing, sideways to the road, facing north up the railroad track, directly in line with it. She put a light foot on the gas and steered carefully and got her right-hand wheels up on the right-hand rail. Her left-hand wheels were down on the ties. The whole car was tilted at a decent angle. She drove on, not fast, not slow, but decisive and confident. She went straight, one hand on the wheel, one hand in her lap, past the water tower, then onward. Her left-hand wheels pattered over the ties. Her right-hand wheels ran smooth. A fine piece of car control. Then she braked gently, one side up, one side down, and she came to a neat stop on the track, 20 yards north of the water tower, right where Reed Riley's car had waited for the train. Where the broken glass began, I said, you've done this before. She said,
yes, I have.